From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, prosecutors are dropping all criminal charges against eight people in the Flint water scandal and starting the investigation over again. We'll have the latest. Plus, an Upper Peninsula senator makes his case for the proposed Line 5 tunnel.
We can wait the 5 years to build this tunnel. We can sustain the level of risk because it is a very low level of risk.
The bitter fruit of the January polar vortex, peach crops being hit hard and farmers trying to stay hopeful.
If this was easy, everyone would do it. We farm because it's what we love.
And the future of smart ships on the Great Lakes.
These types of unoccupied vessels are best designed to do are things that satisfy what we call the three D's: dull, dirty, and dangerous.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we begin today with breaking news from the criminal prosecutions in the Flint water crisis. Prosecutors say they are dismissing all charges against eight people, and they're starting over. Here now is MLive's reporter out of Flint, Ron Fonger. Ron, were you surprised by this move?
Yeah, good afternoon, Cynthia. This is was a bombshell. We were anticipating a ruling coming down on the Nick Lyon case, the former health director for the state of Michigan, in Genesee Circuit Court tomorrow. The judge was being asked to dismiss that case, and on the eve of it, in fact, not one, but all eight remaining charges are out the door in the water prosecutions.
Remind us who these people are who were criminally charged.
You've got... the highest ranking official is Nick Lyon, who was bound over to stand trial on charges including involuntary manslaughter. You had the former health executive for the state of Michigan, Eden Wells, and then you had some mid-level officials from the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Environmental Quality. And then you had a couple of former emergency managers of Flint and the former Department of Public Works director from the city of Flint.
And we should remind everybody that Nick Lyon is the former state health director. So Solicitor General Fadwa Hamoud and Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy put out a statement, and they say the charges were being dismissed without prejudice. What does that mean, and why are they doing this?
Well, they are portraying this as the beginning of a new investigation. With these cases, you know, the cases were dismissed without prejudice, so these individuals could be pursued again. That's the way they're portraying it, and it's kind of the culmination of this rift that has gone on between the administration of Dana Nessel and former Attorney General Bill Schuette and the Special Prosecutor Todd Flood, who brought these charges in the first place.
Have you seen? What's happened over the last months that seem to, perhaps, if you look back now, signal that this decision might be coming?
We've had prosecutors coming in with the Solicitor General into court on some of these cases, asking for delays, asking for 6-month delays in a lot of these cases. Because of what they say was the discovery of kind of a sloppy discovery process. They say that a lot of the information that was gathered in response to investigative subpoenas ended up not having been properly reviewed, and they wanted more time to review these materials. And in at least one instance, they came very close a few weeks ago to saying that they were ready to walk away from these cases if they didn't get that time. And in some cases they were granted some that additional time, and in some cases they were not. But in the end, they're saying there were such problems with the investigation under Flood and Schuette that they're not going to go forward with them. They don't feel comfortable with the cases. They don't feel good about them.
Attorney General Dana Nessel, after this came out, put her statement out saying justice delayed is not justice denied. Have you had a chance to get any reaction from people in Flint to what happened?
We have a couple people doing that now. we just got a statement from the mayor of Flint, and she seems to be somewhat supportive of the attorney general's position in this. The mayor is saying she's happy that someone is, you know, going to be giving this investigation the attention it deserves and so on. We are kind of gathering reactions
sure.
as we go along.
Well, this story just broke. So, Ron, where are you going to focus your reporting in the coming hours and days?
Well, we're asking people who've been involved in this, we're asking the people from Flint what their thoughts are about it. I guess we see where things are going to go with this criminal investigation. It seems like a long road back, but we'll find out where they're going with this. I think that for this to have happened, for all of these cases that a lot of people in Flint have been following closely for several years now, to be all dismissed in one fell swoop, it is disappointing, I think. There's at least an element of that, and it's just we're back to ground zero. You know, no one spent a day in jail for what happened to the Flint water system. No one paid a dollar in fines, and we'll see if more charges are to come, but right now it's a big zero.
Ron Fonger, MLive's Flint reporter. Ron, thank you so much for the late breaking update.
No problem. Thank you.
Governor Whitmer has ordered a study of alternatives to Line 5, seeking other ways of meeting the energy needs of the Upper Peninsula. On Tuesday, UP Senator Ed McBroom spoke to the Senate.
Last week, the governor issued an executive order that seems, in my mind, to be made out of an abundance of caution, but out of a lack of information.
And Senator Ed McBroom, GOP from Vulcan, is with us now. Senator, what is the information you feel the governor's missing?
Well, that several studies have already been conducted, both by the government and by independent reviews, that answer the very questions that this new study is supposed to find out.
And you say this study, in your words, is fiddling while Rome burns.
Well, in a sense, that may have been a little too dramatic in rhetoric, but I was just speaking extemporaneously. The facts are, though, that the studies in the past, both ones that are pro or opposed to the tunnel and Line 5 itself, show that there is a huge energy demand in the Upper Peninsula that does not have a way of being addressed outside of what we have right now with Line 5. And that's most specifically our propane needs for both the UP and the northern lower can't really be feasibly done economically or through current infrastructure without Line 5.
And I know you talked on the floor of the Senate about what it was like in the winter of 2014 with that propane shortage. So the governor's office says about 25% of residents in the UP heat their homes with propane, mainly from Line 5. So based on the 2010 census population of the UP, we're talking about a little over 75,000 people. Is that a pretty accurate number?
That seems a little bit lower than what I've seen in other information as to how many heat their homes with propane. But, you know, I'd have to go back and look at where her sources are versus the sources I've seen.
Fair enough. So, and in your speech, you say there are really no viable alternatives for people
That's
in
right.
the UP. So I've got to ask, what about trucks like the rest of the state?
So first of all, I mean, we still are using trucks, obviously. But when you talk about the rest of the state, you know, a huge amount of the propane utilized in northern lower is also dependent on Line 5's provision. But specifically to the UP, we have the propane that is taken out of the natural gas mix flowing in Line 5 at the Rapid River plant. Then that is distributed across the Upper Peninsula through trucks. The reason why they're not a viable alternative to that line supply is that in 2014, when Line 5 had been shut down, our trucks in Michigan aren't allowed to load in Wisconsin. So we were forced to drive those trucks to Missouri, to Arkansas, Oklahoma, other places in order to get loaded. That's an enormous amount of distance to cover. You have to
rescind a lot of the time of day travel regs for the truckers. And on top of that, even all that aside, in order to completely lose the propane from Line 5, you're talking about 200 trucks a day of propane being imported into the Upper Peninsula year-round. So that's why all those reasons together or alone can only be reasonably said to be not be a viable alternative.
Senator, people who oppose Line 5 argue 5 years is too long to wait to get that pipeline out of the water and into a tunnel. They point to last year's anchor strike as an example of why it needs to be addressed immediately. What did that anchor strike signal to you?
Well, several things. One, it was the first and only time it has happened in over 60 years and was done clearly by somebody who's just not at all following the rules, and the rules that have been enacted even since then are even more stringent and more in line with penalties. So the likelihood is tremendously diminished. On top of all that, the line sustained that impact and is not didn't leak, doesn't seem to have even come close to leaking. And so to me, all those things together stand to reason that we can wait the 5 years to build this tunnel. We can sustain the level of risk because it is a very low level of risk, as the anchor strike last year proved.
So in our final few seconds, how would you balance the energy needs of the people of the UP with concerns for the Great Lakes?
I'd build a tunnel, especially a tunnel that's completely paid for without taxpayer dollars. The tunnel is the way to strike that balance. I'd be okay with building a whole new line or doing some other things too, but to some people, that's too much risk. Building the tunnel is the right solution, and we should get it done as quickly as possible and not keep throwing up roadblocks of studies or lawsuits.
GOP Senator Ed McBroom of the 38th District, Vulcan, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Coming up, look, Ma, no helm.
It looks just like a normal boat, point at one end and square at the other. It's powered by a small diesel engine, but there's no place for people.
Will driverless boats be here before driverless cars? That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. After 92 years, the struggle to stay alive has ended for Mary Grove College. The Northwest Detroit Liberal Arts College will close in December. So what's ahead for the 53-acre campus? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, the school cut out undergrad, focused on graduate courses, but it wasn't enough to survive. So apart from sentimental ties, how big a loss is this for Southeast Michigan?
Well, yes, I think in some ways it is. The good news, though, is that the property is not going to go dark. I think that was the real concern 2 years ago when they really, as they were sinking into a very deep financial hole at the end of 2016 and early 2017. The president at the time reached out to the Kresge Foundation because I think she knew they had no plan, and a financial collapse would mean likely that, as they say over there, that place would go dark, and they didn't want that to happen. This is an important neighborhood that is rejuvenating itself in Detroit. And so they began a process to go to graduate education, as you said, but also to start to transform some of the campus into a what they're calling a P20 educational complex.
Yes, and this is a new way of education, a new model for Detroit education. So tell us about P20. I know there's a lot of members in the coalition.
Right. You've got the Kresge Foundation. You have the University of Michigan School of Education. You've got Starfish Family Services. Those are the main ones. And so Starfish will be running an early childhood center that will be built with Kresge money. They're moving ahead with that. We expect to see renderings and hear who the contractor is sometime this summer and breaking ground by the end of the year. So that's moving ahead. The first class, a ninth grade class of what they're calling the school at Marygrove with the at sign, the school at Marygrove. Ninth grade class, about 120 students will be there in the fall. So again, they will be on campus before Marygrove officially ends its existence, really, and at the end of the fall semester in December. So that's going to be moving ahead, and that school will continue to populate. Now, obviously, with Marygrove disappearing, you are going to have some holes in that P through 20, P being preschool, and then you're having K-12, and then you're having undergraduate and graduate. The University of Michigan also is created in its School of Education a residency program that's patterned after the hospital residency program. They're very familiar to medical students around the country.
Yes.
And these are either undergraduate, graduates, or graduate students who can come and teach at the new school under the aegis of more veteran teachers. So it's very similar to what you see on hospital shows, frankly, in terms of the concept of what they want to do. Now, the question becomes, who fills that higher education void? As I reported in my column today, there are already very high-level discussions, I think, going on between the Kresge Foundation and the University of Michigan School of Education, and probably Oakland University as well, about how one of those might be able to fill that void. Probably not both of them. It might be too small a space for both of them to play on the same campus, but that remains to be seen. I think the University of Michigan's president, Mark Schlissel, is very keen to raise the university's profile in Detroit, and I think is looking for the right kind of thing for them. And he's looking at some other things, and I don't think it has to just be one. But I think that's the way this plays out. So the good news is that 2 years later, they have a plan that when Marygrove collapsed, there's other things that are going to keep that site occupied. There's going to be redevelopment and other things. And they're looking at this whole concept of using P20 education as a way to not only educate public education, but also community redevelopment.
It's actually building a model that could be applied. You know, they're going to learn things that could be used elsewhere around Michigan. But also, we won't see these beautiful buildings decaying, because I know these buildings. I was married there. My mother has graduated from Marygrove, and I went to high school at Immaculata, which was right on the corner. Mm-hmm. It was built in the 1940s. And we've seen it all too often where these architectural gems, you know, times change. They empty out, they close, and we watch them rot.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. And I think it is, if people haven't seen it, it is a pristine, you feel like you're in England or somewhere in the Ivy League or
English
Yale.
Gothic.
Or Yale, yeah, English Gothic. But, you know, it's really important to point out here that the school that's going to be here, the P through 20, but particularly the K through 12 school, is a Detroit public school community district school. This is public education. This is not a charter school. This is not a private school, an independent school, or a Catholic school. It is a public school, and it is a model. It's going to be called one of their schools of achievement. I think one of five, maybe, in the district. This is a model, and the superintendent is very much behind it. I'm told that the principal that they've chosen is a real hotshot. I don't know the person, but I'm told is very impressive, and they're really moving. They're going to move ahead with this, and I think that's the good news in all of this.
Sentimentally, it's sad to see Marygrove go, but it's good to see that space be reinvented for the 21st century.
That's exactly right. And I think a lot of the people at the Kresge Foundation and the other organizations think that they may be shaping a model that can not only be replicated in Michigan, but can be replicated around the country.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
With all the talk about self-driving cars zipping along our roads and highways, we've overlooked developments in autonomous ships that could one day be dominating the waters of the Great Lakes. When the Great Lakes governors and premiers of Ontario and Quebec open their 2019 summit tomorrow, one thing on their schedule will be a demonstration of a so-called smart ship. Guy Meadows directs the Great Lakes Research Center at Michigan Tech University, where he specializes in marine engineering. Guy, tell us about the ship the governors and premiers will see.
Well, from the university's perspective, we're very interested in autonomous research vessels as opposed to large freight-carrying vessels, as you indicated. So what we're going to show is what we believe to be the world leader in autonomous surface vessels, which is a company called L3 ASV Global. They have brought up a 18-foot research vessel that is fully autonomous and can operate for up to 7 days, 24 hours a day, totally unattended. We will not be operating it unattended. We will be operating it under what we and the Coast Guard have agreed to, being supervised autonomy. So it's going to be a nice show, we hope, and we're in the process right now of loading up a very fancy sonar so that we can provide live video feed of the bottom underneath the vehicle as it's doing its autonomous survey.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing is what you've agreed to with the Coast Guard is kind of like autonomous with training wheels.
Exactly. And the Coast Guard has been just tremendous to work with. This is obviously new technology in the marine environment. There are no real definitive rules at this point. So part of what we've done is developed a marine autonomy test center up at Michigan Tech in the waters surrounding the university, and working very closely with the Coast Guard to employ best practices and together develop rules for the safe operation of these types of vessels.
Guy, give us an idea. What does this ship look like? Would we recognize it as something different from what we're used to seeing?
You sure would. It's bright yellow for safety reasons. As I said, it's about 18 feet. Can go down the road on a trailer, so it would be easy for universities across the Great Lakes basins to share these vessels, which is our plan. Looks just like a normal boat, 0.8 one end and square at the other. It's powered by a small diesel engine, which gives it the 7 day duration. But there's no place for people. It has a complete deck, waterproof from the top side as well as obviously the bottom side. It's a little different looking.
Guy, where does technology for autonomous vessels stand right now?
Way behind that for autonomous land vehicles, and that's part of the governor's and premier's interest, is to leverage the tremendous technology that the automobile companies throughout the Great Lakes Basin are developing and to leverage that into the marine sector. So we're hoping to improve on these vessels, which are quite capable at this time, but again, we're interested in testing their safety features, further developing their autonomy and their usefulness. We held a national workshop 3 years ago, and the consensus of the workshop is that these types of unoccupied vessels are best designed to do are things that satisfy what we call the three D's: dull, dirty, and dangerous. And an example of each would be: dull would be resurveying the Great Lakes, which is really necessary, that in some places the surveys are 100 years old. Dangerous are things of that you would not want to risk human exposure. There would be cleanups of contaminant spills, collisions between ships, oil spills, things of that nature. And that also goes into the dangerous category. So on the research side, the dangerous category for us is to make measurements when it's not safe to have human crews. So early in the spring, when there's still ice present, we can't have our ships and our buoys and other sensors in the water. This would be a great opportunity to be able to make critical measurements when there's no other way to do that.
So certainly then these unoccupied vessels can change the way scientists do research on the Great Lakes, and I'm sure that could also be applied to the oceans.
Oh, absolutely. This particular vehicle has been used extensively in the Gulf of Mexico and in the offshore of Alaska, primarily in support of oil exploration. So they've also been used in the search for Malaysia Flight 370, where, again, multiple of these vehicles are used simultaneously with a mothership to greatly increase the coverage area.
Could we see this someday as this technology is developed and gets better and better? Could it be used on larger ships? Could it be used, for example, for businesses that want to ship goods?
Oh, absolutely. And there are parts of the autonomous shipping industry that are moving in that direction. The Norwegians, for example, are in the process of building an autonomous freighter. We're a long ways away from wanting to do that here in the United States, but the advanced autonomy and the aid that these vehicles incorporate in their programming can be of use to commercial shipping and doing some of the very difficult maneuvers that they have to do, like entering the locks and docking and things of that nature. So there's applications that will not only create jobs throughout the Great Lakes, but make our waterways safer.
Well, when you say create jobs, I wondered what that could mean for ship pilots and crew.
For ship pilots and crew, it would be different types of operations than they're presently doing. But again, in developing this technology, there's tremendous opportunity for both the technicians to maintain and operate these systems, as well as for the engineering and science that goes into creating the systems in the first place. Part of the governor's and premier's interest is to use our capacity here throughout the Great Lakes Basin to become an exporter worldwide of these technologies. We think we could lead the market in that rather than playing catch up.
Guy, could smart ships change the way that the rest of us, we civilians, want to interact with the lakes, play on the lakes, and enjoy them?
I don't think so. The Norwegians are working very hard with their autonomous freighter, which will become operational in 2020, to make sure that it does not interfere. Our plans up in Lake Superior, part of the reason for choosing that is it's a very low marine traffic area. The Coast Guard has recommended that they transmit a notice to mariners to let people know that an autonomous ship will be operating or vessel will be operating. But again, it's not autonomous. There will be a supervisory vessel that can take control at any moment. So our goal is to make sure that we do this on a non-interference basis.
In our last few moments, tell us, in 20 years, what will be fundamentally different about the Great Lakes because of smart ship technology?
We hope they'll be cleaner, the water will be cleaner, that invasive species will be better understood, that we'll have better bottom maps of not only the depth of the lake, but the substrates and who lives where, what sort of areas need to be protected, what sort of areas don't need to be supervised, all those things that we just don't have the person power right now to be able to do. We know how to do them, but again, to be able to run these vessels ultimately, continuously for a week at a time, would be a tremendous leap forward for the science community, and that's our primary interest.
Guy Meadows directs the Great Lakes Research Center at Michigan Tech. Thanks so much, Guy, for sharing your work with us.
Oh, thank you for the interest. We appreciate it. Have a good day.
It's just about the oldest form of live entertainment. Busking. Think of that performer on the street corner. That's the busker. That ancient tradition being celebrated this weekend in Imlay City. And we continue our look at quirky summer festivals. It's the Michigan Busker Fest. Shannon Hamels with the Imlay City Chamber of Commerce.
Right. A busker is actually a street performer. So they put out a hat and then they do what they do. It could be from juggling to comedy to fire eating. It doesn't matter, as long as they have a hat out and they are entertaining people.
And I know, just from kind of a little bit of light research, it's been going on literally for centuries, street entertainers. Why did Imlay City decide, hey, let's have a festival to celebrate busking?
Well, we just wanted something unique that nobody really in Michigan has. We went from the blueberry, and now we're doing something, like I said, very unique, and there's never a dull moment.
I'm curious, who connected that idea? Did someone see a busker somewhere and say, hey, let's do that?
Well, Ian Kemp, he's the fair manager for the Eastern Michigan Fair here, and he is on my committee, my festival committee, and he, if you can imagine, goes to tons of festivals and fairs, and they're big in Canada and Europe. Well, he went to the ones in Canada and just thought bringing that to Imlay City would be a perfect fit.
Very fun. So I know you're importing an array of buskers, and I looked at the website to MichiganBuskerFest.com, and it promises amazing acts of skill, bravery, insanity. Give us an idea of what people will see, who you're bringing in.
Well, we are bringing in people from the West Coast to the East Coast, like Ohio Burn Unit. They're from Ohio, of course. They eat fire. They eat fire, they throw fire, and like whips with fire. It's just something you'll never see in person, or you probably have never seen in person. It's just, they make it so exciting. And then Stamp Boogie, he is from Boston, and he was on, actually, America's Got Talent. He was a finalist. So we're bringing him in. He jumps over 5-6 people at a time. He does the break dancing and alley oops. They're a vaudeville comedy. Miss Jane, she balances on the top of bottles. So it's exciting and scary at the same time to watch.
So this is certainly a whole lot more than somebody with a guitar singing on the corner.
Sure.
Not that that isn't fun to see, too, but certainly it sounds like a big array of different kinds of things. What does a festival like this, Shannon, do for a small town like Imlay City?
It draws people in. It just, some people don't even know we have a downtown. So with this festival, they see unique. And they want to see things they've never seen before and things that will scare them. And that brings them to our downtown. And they could see what Imlay City has in store for them also.
And I know you've got a very busy schedule, the Michigan Busker Fest, happening this Friday through Saturday in Imlay City. You can go to MichiganBuskerFest.com, get all the details, keeping a very ancient tradition alive in Imlay City. Shannon Hamill, thanks so much, and here's to terrific weather for the weekend.
Yes, thank you so much.
Coming up, the bitter harvest from the polar vortex and what it could mean for the future of fruit in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Take one professor of biomedical engineering and materials science, add one physician who lectures in anesthesiology, shake in their mutual passion for sports, and pour it out. You get their new book, Corked, Tales of Advantage in Competitive Sports. They're applying their scientist brains and sports lover's heart to look at the ways teams and players get a competitive edge that really has little to do with the skill or talent of the players. Here now from the University of Michigan, we begin with the engineer, Brian Love. Welcome.
Thanks, Cindy.
And Dr. Michael Burns, the physician. Welcome to Stateside. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about some examples. As I was going through your book, the Stanley Cup Finals are on, and you kind of start right out of the gate talking about bad ice, how NHL teams keep their ice frozen. So how does a team's ice hurt or help?
Well, anyone who's played hockey before knows that sometimes the ice is of poor quality, and you have that same level of play, but a poor surface to play on, and it evens things out. So you take a skilled player and you put him against more of the brute force player, give him a bad surface to play on, and they're almost equal.
And what did you learn about what it takes to make good ice?
Well, there's the composition of the actual freezing fluid that is part of the process for sure. There's this issue of layering of the ice levels. There are even building and design considerations. If you don't have the right heat transfer rates associated with the rate of freezing of the ice from all of the HVAC system that's included, you can run into instances where the production of the ice essentially has air pockets that are contained within the ice itself, and that leads to chipping and, you know, much crummier ice altogether.
You also argue that the vaunted home ice advantage is becoming less important in hockey. Why is that?
Yeah, that has to do with the standardization of the rinks. So this was some years back. They decided, well, we're a big enough league that we can start forcing teams to have a standard rink, therefore no sharp angle corners, no deep blue lines and or creases for the goalies at weird angles or places. And that just made it easier. You always think of like lucky bounces and home court advantage in the way that players practice on these fields over and over again, therefore they know where all the bounces and weird things happen. The league was trying to make that normalized. I also think that the NHL, as opposed to all the other sports, has a harder time giving a home ice advantage because the fans are so far away from the action. So the ice is the ice, whereas you look at something like the NBA and you have, you know, rap star Drake right in front of the players, you know, talking trash right in their face and then going and giving the coach a back rub. So it doesn't happen in hockey. That's, you know, you're separated by an ice and...
And the plexiglass to keep you safe.
Exactly.
And that actually, speaking of Drake, kind of leads into a chapter you've got titled Mascots, Rally Monkeys, Flora and Fauna, Both Alive and Dead, How Costumes, Animals, and Carcasses Affect the Game. What are you digging into with this?
Well, you know, I mean, at the most basic level, most competition looks a little bit like simulated war. In football, the teams come out, you know, there's a large fanfare, there's a large army of people that sort of run out onto the field in football. The mascot, you know, the band, all of these sort of things are all there. And it's designed as, you know, subtle intimidation, if you want to call it that.
And are there some that are more intimidating than others?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean,
for instance,
there are teams that just have mascots that look somewhat irreverent at best, as you can describe. There are teams that have, you know, essentially no mascot at the current moment. You know, the Fighting Illini used to have Chief Illini Wick for the University of Illinois, and you know, he has been retired, as the case may be. And so there's no fanfare for certain locations.
University of Michigan.
University of Michigan doesn't have a mascot.
But Michigan State has Sparty.
Right, exactly. So there's an opportunity to sort of present these things.
Does having a Sparty kind of help the team plug into some extra energy?
I suppose that's probably true. I think it's more actually for intimidation, though, if you want to think about it. So, you know, I think the best example is the University of Colorado. They have this woolly mammoth that essentially runs out onto the field. I mean, how does not tearing
it's
up the field?
Buffalo.
Well, okay, fair enough. But if the animal isn't tearing up the field, you know, at least it's an impressive kind of presentation altogether.
It's certainly with the Red Wings and the history of tossing the octopus on the ice goes back decades.
Oh, yeah, and that's great. I think it's a way that fans get involved, and then the teams, whether or not you truly believe that people are involved emotionally in these games, the players, you know, you just gave up a goal and someone throws an octopus on the ice after some sort of stoppage and everyone just starts roaring and taunting you. It's got to do something.
Yeah.
A pertinent topic in Michigan with the recent construction of Little Caesars Arena as a new home for the Detroit Red Wings and the Detroit Pistons. And you posed the question, does building a new arena improve a team's chances of winning? So what do the numbers and the data tell us? Does it?
I think that it's more about the algorithm that goes into designing the stadium tied to the actual money arrangement, if you really want to think about it. There are all sorts of revenue streams that are linked with building a stadium. And I think there are fewer instances where having larger numbers necessarily matters. The gates fee per person attending is actually probably more important at this point in terms of what a team owner would be most interested in. The actual gate receipts associated with the fans that are actually crossing through the gates is a smaller and smaller fraction with TV revenue, with branding and merchandising. It's a much smaller piece of the pie at this point. And so you can design buildings and stadiums with more the line of the fan experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually working against the team in some ways. You know, if everybody is more worried about having sufficient internet access that they can be Twittering and Facebooking their friends during the game, that's fewer people who are actually watching the game altogether.
You know, what Brian's alluding to is things like skyboxes.
Yes.
So the people who are in the skyboxes pay more per capita, but they're probably not that engaged. And they're definitely not making that much of a difference to the players on the field. The Golden State Warriors are opening a brand new stadium that has a whole lot of other nice entities inside the buildings that the Golden State Warriors will own. These are things like shopping centers, malls, apartment complexes. And they're offering tickets to fans so they don't have an actual seat, but they can come to the arena.
And mill around.
Mill around. And, you know, some of the ties are going to be to now the legalization of sports betting, where you can go in there and bet on the game. But you're not going to have any influence on it because you can't even get to the arena. You'll just be in the sub-parts of the arena, but it's another way that they can drive revenue. So clearly these teams are looking to make money and not necessarily win games all the time.
Was there any way of figuring out whether a new arena, whether a team wins more after getting a spiffy new home?
Yeah, that's what we found so far is no. There's no correlation.
Interesting. And just kind of thinking of Little Caesars Arena with all the extra stuff to do that wasn't there when they were at Joe Louis Arena. You didn't go to Kid Rock's bar, but they had to change the seats out because the red seats really jumped out because they were empty during the games because people are out milling around on the, you know, on the concourse and not watching the game. You know, milling around. They may have sold the ticket, but it looked kind of empty. They've changed all the seats and made them black seats.
Yeah.
You dedicated your book to the fans, the players, and the team owners, probably in that order. Who chose that choice of words and why?
Well,
Brian.
I mean, we are old-time sports fans, I guess, if you really want to go to it. This is a book that, you know, is part history lesson, part a little bit of scientific enterprise. part gamesmanship, if you want to really get to it. And we think the fans are probably the most interested in that kind of venture, because those are the sorts of questions that we sort of posed to ourselves and, you know, had the most sort of chatter and chat back in terms of talking with other friends as we were sort of constructing this all together.
Well, the book is Corked, Tales of Advantage in Competitive Sports, the kind of sports book you haven't seen before, where you will really learn all kinds of new things about sports you thought you knew and what it takes to tip the advantage competitively. And the authors are University of Michigan professors Brian J. Love and Michael L. Burns, applying their scientist brains and their sports lover's heart to this question of how athletes and teams win. Fun talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us.
We may be enjoying warm late spring days right now, but there are fruit farmers in Michigan suffering from last winter's polar vortex. Let's find out how and which crops are hurting. Bill Shane is with MSU's Southwest Michigan Research and Extension Center. He's a tree fruit specialist. Bill, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And we want to welcome Carrie Moulter of Moulter Family Orchards. They're in Benton Harbor. Carrie, welcome and hello.
Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for having me.
Bill, Michigan really caught that blast of polar air back in late January. We saw, some of us saw the temperature go down to 20 below. So what has that done to tree fruit crops?
There's actually two events. There's one on the 21st and one on the close to the 31st of January. So both have the effect. The first one was a still condition, meaning that the temperatures were colder at the bottom of the hill. The second one was a moving air event, which means both the top and the bottom of the hill were affected. And those temperatures, whenever we get below about minus 13, we know that we will have problems with our most sensitive tree fruit. Peaches tends to be the most sensitive on the list. And then as temperatures go below that, then some of the other stone fruits start to get affected, apricots, sweet cherries, plums. And then the most resistant ones tend to be the pears and the apples. Grapes are, depending on the type of grape, tend to be as sensitive as peaches. We know with those temperatures, even without going out and looking at the plants, that we had damage on at least our peaches and our vinifera grapes. And so that was pretty universally over the southwest Michigan area. Once we get beyond the Allegan area, going north, the Fendel-Allegan area, they did not receive that same type of temperature regime and less damage.
And I know there are a lot of peaches grown in southeast Michigan. Romeo has their big peach festival to celebrate that. What are you hearing from your counterparts there?
Apparently they've had about the same conditions. We might be a little bit worse than them, but still a significant hit, at least on the peach crop.
All right, so significant hit on the peach crop. Carrie Moulter, tell us about the peach trees you have at Moulter Family Orchards.
We have one orchard on one site and total loss. We will not be picking, seeing any peaches there. We did not have any blossoms on those peach trees. It is not our highest site. Everything at the end of the day comes down to location and elevation. If you have some good air drainage off your orchard, it also would be a big benefit. We do have an orchard, however, that it is blessed with high ground and good drainage. We do have some peaches. It just comes down to questioning which ones will actually be viable at, you know, the end of the season. And if you put the energy into working on and maintaining such a limited crop.
That has to be the work you put into these trees and into getting this crop, and then to have like this sucker punch of cold air, this polar vortex, that really must be tough.
It is. And I think one thing I would like to stress is it's very important to stay positive and, you know, watch your morale. If this was easy, everyone would do it. And we farm because it's what we love. I think that's true for the majority of farmers in our area. Does it hurt? Yes. Does it hurt to drive down the road and not see the beautiful peach blossoms this year? It did. But we're still going to have 2020. It's going to come here whether we like it or not, and we've got that to look forward to.
That is something that strikes me every time I talk to someone in Michigan's farming community, is you got to keep that eternal optimism going.
We try.
Bill, didn't fruit farmers in Michigan get badly hammered by a late cold spell in 2012?
Yes, and that was kind of unusual for us to be hit that late. We do have these episodes every so often. 94 was a year very similar to this current year as far as damage, and growers did rebound from that after some replanting. I should also mention that the Grand Rapids area have a pretty normal peach crop, so I know people down this way are seeking their friends up there as a source of peaches for farm markets down here. So it's not going to be, you know, completely without peaches down here. There are quite a few peaches growing in the Grand Rapids area.
So they kind of missed the brunt of what hit, for example, the Benton Harbor area where you are, Carrie.
Yeah. And that 2012, it was an event that farmers in our area, you know, it's the likes of they had never seen before. I think Bill could probably back me up, but I think that last frost that year was April 24th. Hmm. I don't think anyone slept that night. We watched temperatures. People were, you know, trying to keep air moving in the orchards. But just like next year, you know, 2013, we were all still farming, and it's what we got to do.
Carrie, can the trees recover from this? So you say it's so sad, you see no blossoms and that. Will the trees recover, or do you need to wind up buying new trees?
There are different factors that go into that, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. The age of the tree, perhaps if the tree had already been trimmed for the year. And again, location, you know, how hard that specific tree and orchard had been hit. From my experience, the younger trees and the much older trees tend to be more sensitive, but that would depend on the variety as well sometimes.
Yeah, we, Carrie pointed out rightly that the quality or the health of the tree has a big to do with it. The tree has a kind of a conducting system around it and growth of the cambium layer. And as the tree ages, it becomes weaker. And so if we have a freeze damage, it causes damage to the trunk. We lose more of that, the what you might call the plumbing of the tree. And at a certain point, there's not enough to sustain the tree. And so we do know that there are orchards that are already showing signs of trunk splitting, where they didn't green up, or they're starting to decline, and other ones that look just fine. So it's what we experienced back in 94, and so it's something that growers have to do. One of the strategies that every grower should be doing is having different ages of orchards, so whenever we have one of these events, that they don't wipe out their farming operation for, say, peaches.
Bill, how high could losses go for farmers in Southwest Michigan?
I would say it's in the millions, but how high, we're still figuring out the amount of actual loss. As Carrie mentioned, there are some places that will have some peaches. Mm-hmm. Again, as you go north, they are back to normal production. So we'd need to do that calculation again. But about 50% of the peaches are grown down in Southwest Michigan, mm-hmm. and majority of those are gone. It's almost half of the peach crop. There's a lot of processing peaches that are grown up by Hart Shelby that are doing just fine.
And is it fair to say consumers might have to expect higher prices?
Kind of yes and kind of no, because Michigan does not grow enough peaches to supply the chain stores. So a lot come in from South Carolina and California. Mm-hmm. Peaches in Michigan tend to go for farm markets, and the supply will be shorter. I know many farm marketers are trying to not raise the prices too much, but it will be higher, I would guess.
Carrie, final question. Do you have other crops, fruit and vegetable crops, that can help kind of cushion this peach loss for you?
Yes. Our farm made the decision after there was a partial frost in 2009. And at that time, we only had apple orchards. After that, we decided to diversify to try and prevent, you know, a total wipeout in the event of a singular crop failure. That's what saved us after 2012. So we do grow other crops. We do a lot of dry vegetables, kale, cabbage, green beans, and corn as well, in addition to apples.
How are your apples looking?
So far, so good.
There's that eternal optimism. There you go. Carrie Moulter of Moulter Family Orchards and Bill Shane with the MSU Southwest Michigan Research and Extension Center. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us, Cynthia.
And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lester Graham is here tomorrow, and I will see you on Monday. Thank you so very much for listening.